Victoria Young is with us now. She's been inspired by the bank's reporting season. Kia ora, Victoria.
Good morning. I don't know if inspired is the right word for it, but I'm keen to talk about it.
She is Business Desk editor. We were speaking this morning to the Westpac chief executive a little bit on the results, but also on the action is grindingly, slowly for many people happening with the banks with respect to scams. But just looking into their results, for example, I think 11% the net profit, but that was largely impacted by a one-off adjustment, and an underlying figure was not so pretty. Their margins on lending over borrowing was something like just a shade under 2.1%, the difference they make between what they pay out in interest and what they get. What did you make of the results that have come out of the bank so far?
Yeah, that's definitely, that net interest margin is definitely the one that I'm quite interested in. And we've got BNZ, Westpac and ANZ, which was just out this morning saying that is, those are being squeezed. But, you know, people would say, rightly so, the economy is struggling, and the bank results sort of reflect what's going on in their wider economy. So if you looked at, Westpac's net profit was up, but that was due to the way that it forecast weather events, and this is for the 6 months, of course. BNZ down 5.3, ANZ cash profit is flat, and if you did statutory net profit after tax, yeah, that's down as well. And so, yeah, that's what we're interested in, that net interest margin. So they are getting squeezed, but we're interested also in what the banks are saying about the next 6 months. And it sort of varies a little bit. I mean, these bank CEOs can be a bit nuanced and sort of speak like politicians at times. But the feeling that I'm getting from, you know, the interviews that our reporters have had is that, I mean, definitely till the end of the year, they're expecting this squeeze. But, you know, BNZ is thinking it's going to be a tougher environment that's going to flow into next year. Others are a little bit more optimistic. I mean, ANZ this morning was saying, well, a lot of their home owners, what have they got? They've only got 17% of those customers on rates lower than 5%. So this transition, sort of this movement into this higher interest rate environment, I mean,
is now it's lagging. True.
But we're thinking that maybe it's gone through, and maybe it's okay. Well, I don't think we've hit the worst of it. I don't think most economists would say that, but it's looking like maybe we could be optimistic early next year.
Well, that date's already gone back. I mean, the talk about having interest rate cuts later this year, most banks are starting to push back to late this year, if not into next year. I guess the thing about the percentage of their books that are now on higher rates, that was what we were waiting for, because no matter how much you ramp up the cash rate, until people are exposed to it, they don't necessarily amend behaviour. And now if most are exposed to it, you see the amended behaviour, you see the amended stress. And also we're starting to see the other things that lag, including unemployment gradually rising.
Yeah, that's the next one.
But it's a long, slow train.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unemployment, what was it, steady? 4.3% last week was the latest figure. So that's coming up too. And yeah, I mean, so among these banks, BNZ, Dan Haggins, he's saying they're actually gaining market share in this environment. It doesn't seem very competitive at the moment, but they are talking about the other things that they're doing to support their customers at the moment. They are talking about, they're wanting to talk a lot about scams. That's true. And they're wanting to talk a little bit about, you know, the way that they say that they support the economy. The other interesting commentary that's come out among this set of results is from Westpac's Catherine McGrath, because she is pointing out within the business loan book, I mean, obviously we, you know, talk about homeowners a lot, but within the business loan book, hospitality and retail, yep, they're doing it the hardest at the moment. And that's something that's we're likely to see through in the next 6 months as well.
Okay, interesting stuff. Any other results? I just saw an hour, 11 o'clock news, I think ANZ's steady first half result.
Yeah.
Bank's performance slowed in the second half of last year. economic pressures likely to continue throughout the year. Unemployment sector expected to rise further. But there's been no result out of release so far out of the banks that is a shock, so to speak.
No. I mean, ANZ this morning, what we expected and mirroring what the other banks were saying. And then ASB, they are on a slightly different cycle. So I think they will give us a quarterly update next week. But these are the banks that are on the March 31 reporting season, whereas ASB is not. You can get a decent picture from those three. We think,
that endless navel-gazing over interest rates, but I mean, it's affected by multiple things. There's the cash rate itself, and then, as Catherine McGrath was telling us this morning, and actually banks are always in a hurry to tell you, there's the wholesale rates as well, and they've been on a rollercoaster ride in recent months. This is the rates at which they have to borrow on the international market. But again, if you look overseas now at the US, and again, expectations that we'd be starting to see cash rate cuts there, that's starting now to falter.
It has the
stench of a prolonged nasty recession, doesn't it?
It may do. Yep. I think it's hard to say.
Well, as I said, those optimistic dates for when cash rate cuts might come here seem to be sneaking back from most commentators, sneaking backwards in time. What else have you been delving into?
So our agriculture reporter, Viola Kennedy, has been delving into an area we don't usually talk about, but the quite usually secretive dairy goat cooperative. There's a bit of ructions going on there, and they've been having meetings. And in fact, since we first reported on this issue, the chair of that cooperative, it's about 70 farms, so decent size, you know, $100 million in revenue this cooperative makes. Campbell Story, the chair, has indicated that he will resign now because farmers are basically, you know, really unhappy. The farm gate price for goat milk is down by about 50% in recent years, and apparently it's, you know, they've got stock, you know, piling up in their warehouse, which farmers are really, really concerned about.
What's the history of it? Forgive me, the Dairy Goat Cooperative, because of course we think of dairy generally. We think of the big Fonterra sort of merger back in the day, but this cooperative, has it got a long history?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So it's been around since the 80s. There were other dairy goat cooperatives, and it was the first in the world to commercialise goat milk infant formula. So that's the key product. It's not, I mean, I've never even had goat milk on its own. I don't think it's much of a consumer product, except in this infant formula area where it honed in on the Taiwanese market, in early years, based in Hamilton. So, you know, it had contract processes up until 2003, but it's built its own factory. And, you know, it's been trying to develop an industry around goat milk and goat milk infant formula.
And so in terms of its performance and where things are at, is it a case of profits falling? Has it got a farm gate price, as does other parts of the industry?
Yeah, it does. And that's dropped quite a lot. But if we look at the 2023 financial year, so this is the first loss since 2015. So, and it's making revenues. It's $180 million revenue company now. So it's making good money, but it's making good revenue, but you know, the farmers are not happy. And what it's tried to do is it's tried to tee up with the Ministry for Primary Industries, you know, to promote that market and to develop an industry for New Zealand to benefit from. But that really hasn't sort of come to fruition, or it hasn't really paid off. So that's interesting.
So what is happening behind closed doors with the board? Did you get any clarity?
Well, our reporter has been talking to farmers who have been going to, I think there was a meeting in Auckland quite recently, not an official meeting because it has an annual meeting coming up, but there was a meeting for suppliers where they were told, that the quota is going to get dropped and the payout might get better, but there are still a lot of concerns over that. So apparently this meeting was quite, there was quite a lot of discussion at this meeting, and there was quite a lot of pressure put onto the chair. And now the chair has already indicated that he will resign, I think, at the next AGM, or if not sooner. So this is, you know, I mean, it's, you know, organisation performs badly, leadership is being held to account.
What interest does the government show in any way in supporting this industry?
Yeah, that's interesting too, because it has had about $30 million pumped into it through a primary growth partnership aimed at the entire goat infant formula industry. But the partnership was actually through the partnership was between MPI and this cooperative specifically. So the goal for that was to grow the industry to a $400 million industry by 2023, so now. There was a midterm review completed 3 years ago, and the co-op said the landscape's changed, you know, we can't do this. So they are, it's a bit, we're a bit hazy on what the outcomes of this partnership have been, but there has been money spent on it, and money's come from, we should say, it's government money that's sort of been like co-funded with the cooperative itself. It's not just the government giving the cooperative money. They're both putting money into this partnership together. But, you know, this is why the suppliers are upset, because they're worried that this program's not working. They're putting money into something that's basically a dud, and maybe it should go back into the core business. So what happened with the reset 2-3 years ago was that they changed their goal from becoming a $400 million industry by 2023 to a $272 million industry by 2030. So the goalposts have shifted somewhat, and, you know, there's a lot of change being called for at the moment.
All right, let's wait and see what unfolds. Now, the Climate Change Impact Fund. This is interesting. Climate funds are popping up in various places. What's the one you want to talk about?
Yeah, so it's sort of a sort of, it makes sense, really. I mean, so ACC is saying, obviously, they have a range of...
it's one of our biggest investment funds, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But now they're saying that their sort of semi-niche Climate Change Impact Fund, they've had that for 2.5 years, it's redundant now, because everything they do, every investment they do, would consider the impact of climate change. So it's I guess it's a little signal, maybe you could say, about the mainstreaming of climate change. Or, you know, I guess if you're, you know, particular advocates would say, well, that should have been, they should have been looking at this all along. You know, maybe having a limited fund for it was a bit silly. I mean, it's only a, what is it? It's a $100 million fund, and ACC's got a $50 million-ish portfolio. So what they're saying is they're just going to consolidate this climate change special fund into its normal fund, because, you know, investments that are focused on climate change or understanding the impacts of climate change already work as good investments anyway. I think that's the semi-message that you could...
The question is, will they report on investments in this kind of area the way they do when they've got their own fund?
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I don't think they are... They're not legally bound to... I mean, we've discussed this many times, haven't we? It's not a climate reporting entity in the way that the new financial sector regulations are coming in. But it's saying it's going to make voluntary disclosures aligned with those regulations. So I think, you know, it's one of those first or be forced to move kind of things.
It's interesting the sorts of things that it's invested in. One of the climate-related infrastructure investments, reading your reporting, outside the impact fund, was joining a banking syndicate to help finance the sludge minimisation facility at Moa Point, right, designed to reduce emissions. Well, the other thing with ACC, I suppose it's not like the super fund where we all feel like we have some kind of an investment in it, right? Superannuation funds, but it is a big, you know, public quasi-public entity, isn't it? And there will be a level of interest. But
And it's a big fund because our readers, especially, you know, our investors, our professional investors, are just looking at what the other pros do. You know,
true.
So, you know, these guys, Marty Goldfinch, Paul Dyer, these are the pros. They attract like the best talent, you know, investment talent. So they're looking at, hey, what are the big guys doing? What NZX companies are they in, or they're not in, or private? How much private do they have in their portfolio? So, yeah, that's where there it's fascinating, even though it's not like NZ Super where you have that sort of, feeling of contribution.
I think it matters for another reason, to your point. And it's interesting, isn't it, to see a former Green politician like James Shaw off to one of our biggest private sector investment companies, is that where the money goes, where the asset allocation goes, where the capital allocation goes, will have a big impact on whether emissions reduce, continue reducing fast and reduce fast enough or not. In other words, his words were finance is the second biggest area, perhaps after politics, where you'll get change. Others might argue it's got the potential to move faster, actually.
Oh, well,
so what these big funds are doing, what investors are doing and what they're investing in, is of significant general interest, as you say, whether or not there's a legislative requirement to reveal it.
Absolutely. It's market forces versus political forces. I mean, I'm going to tell you this because I'm a business journalist, not a political journalist, right? I think that what the market is doing is, you know, just as interesting and just as important as to what, you know, the politicians are doing on the day. And I think James Shaw's move is a signal of that. He can recognise that if he wants to make, you know, climate-related change, important climate-related change, well, big money guys like Morrison, they're doing it and seeing it, and he can contribute to that.
The irony is that if you look back on the history of climate activism going back to the late 90s, the oil companies themselves, I can remember one famously, its own scientists telling us exactly what was going to happen with the trajectory of emissions and climate. The video is still available online if you Google listeners. If finance and investment is pushing back on the public and diplomatic goals, you come to a horrendous impasse. And if you can finally get some kind of same direction of travel, you might get some momentum into things. So look, all roads lead back to a $100 million fund out of how many billion under management?
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's hoping this is a signal. That financially lucrative investments as well, because this is here to guarantee our ACC scheme, the super fund is here to try and guarantee our retirement incomes. Let's hope that this is a signal that these investments are both profitable and are going to make the changes necessary to help lower emissions. That's the hope and the plan.
That's the sort of the sweet spot. But I mean, yeah, I know along the way it's not all, it won't work like that every single time, but yeah.
Victoria Young's Business Desk's editor.